Hey, Peter.
Hey, Brian.
We're fighting through some technical difficulties here. Viewer beware, but I think we should be good to go. I'm Brian Boitler with Talking Points Memo. I'm stuck in a booth on Capitol Hill.
I am Peter Suderman with Reason Magazine. I am stuck in a house on U Street.
And we're going to be talking about a few things today. Unemployment. What else did we have on tap?
I think we're going to talk about unemployment. We're going to talk about deficits. We're going to talk about the financial regulation bill. We're going to talk about what liberals expect from Obama.
Okay.
And so, if you want to start here, I know you've been on the Hill. You're on the Hill right now. If you can give us a little bit of a summary of what's gone on with the unemployment extension this week.
Right. Democrats, after trying and trying and trying, and first losing several of their own votes, and then losing fewer and fewer, and mainly just struggling with Republican opposition, finally passed a trimmed down stimulative bill to extend unemployment benefits for into the fall, deficit spending bill, which was the grounds for Republican opposition. In the end, they got a couple Republican votes, just enough to get to 60, overcome the filibuster. The bill will be all passed and ready to go to the president in a day or two. And then the unemployment benefits that were lost in the recent weeks will be retroactively restored, and will be good to go for people who can't find work in the crappy economy through November. At which point, probably we'll go through this whole charade again.
Let me ask you, do you think that this is like a political winner for Republicans? I mean, this is it does strike me as in some ways I agree with what they've done. You know, I think there's definitely there are problems with extending unemployment this long, but as a political move, this strikes me as at least a little bit strange. Typically, politicians win by giving things to their constituents. The bill wasn't actually that expensive in the grand scheme of things. And an unemployment bill when you've got 9% plus unemployment doesn't seem like a political winner. I mean, what do you think the Republicans were getting out of this? It seemed like a weird place to take a stand.
Well, I think that they're aware of two things. One, that this vote is has these votes, I guess a series of votes, haven't really been popular, particularly as the unemployment benefits expired and weeks went on, and their own constituents were kind of screwed out of benefits. So on those sort of near-term grounds, no, I don't think it was a political winner, but I think more broadly speaking, a bad economy is good for Republicans right now. I'm not gonna impute those motives to them, although politics is what it is, and there's never been a political party that didn't think to themselves, well, if only we were in power, we could do so much better for our constituents, so let's do what it takes to get there. I think those are the two biggest factors weighing on the Republicans' decision. They're stuck in this mantra that the reason they've been voting against extending unemployment is because they're opposed to all deficit spending, anything that would increase the deficit, they have to oppose. And so their plan was to pay for the unemployment benefits by using unspent stimulus funds. And Democrats wanted no part of that. And so they all voted against it, and they're going to have to live with those votes, but I don't think ultimately those votes are going to harm them that much, particularly because, the broader pain people feel from the bad economy and from being without unemployment, they tend to blame all of that on the incumbents, and the incumbents are Democrats. So.
I guess I'm not. It's not really clear to me why Democrats weren't willing to use stimulus money to pay for this. That seems to me like, I mean, the stimulus wasn't exactly a popular thing, but it strikes me as a way to make the stimulus more popular at this point. It also strikes me as I mean, actually a kind of a clever move by Republicans. But what were Democrats getting out of refusing to use stimulus money? I mean, there's actually a fair bit of it left unspent. at this point. And so and why didn't Democrats want? I mean, you know, Nancy Pelosi came around and said either this morning or yesterday afternoon something to the effect of, you know, unemployment benefits help create jobs, but isn't the stimulus supposed to be there to help create jobs? If that's what this money's going to be doing, then why not use stimulus money for it? If
more jobs.
Unemployment's, right, for jobs.
No, more jobs.
Right. Okay. So this was we've got to add to the argument here is basically just we need to add to the stimulus, not use what's already there.
By and large, you know, I think if Republicans came and said we're really serious about the deficit in this case, and to prove it, we're gonna call for a temporary increase in tax on, you know, the top 1% of earners to raise the however many somewhere in the vicinity of $30 billion it'll cost to extend these unemployment benefits, you might have had some Democratic takers and you might have been able to get it done. But the stimulus bill is basically a jobs and social programs bill, and I don't think there was just any appetite among Democratic leaders to you know, scoop a bucket out of the out of the boat and pour the water right back into the boat. The point is to help more people and get more jobs created, and also not rhetorically damage themselves by basically, copping to the Republican line that the stimulus is a failure and it needs to be wound down and we need to use this money for other things, policy and a political choice the Democrats made not to use that money, but basically it was that these $30 billion are, you know, yay more stimulus, and that'll redound to their benefit.
So it ends up being a way to do at least a little bit more stimulus without really calling it stimulus,
right?
As you said, in November, we will probably, it's not a guarantee, but we will probably go through this again. Gibbs, in a press conference, indicated as much. I don't remember whether it was yesterday or this morning, but Gibbs has basically said, yes, right after the election. And we'll see how, you know, I imagine that the elections will change the politics of this somewhat, and that will figure in. But I wonder how long Democrats can keep doing this and how long it will, you know, how long they can sort of keep adding, even if it's only a relatively small amount, at least in comparison to the original stimulus, how long they can keep adding to the stimulus. I mean, we're not supposed to get we're not expected to get down below 7% unemployment until something like 2013, maybe a little longer than that, as I understand. And you know, 7% is sort of the number when folks start to pull off the unemployment. So, you know, is there 3 years of doing this every 6 months? Is that what we're in store? And is that gonna be a winning thing for Democrats every 6 months here?
Well, you know, winning, not winning. I don't know. Unemployed people not having any money isn't winning for anybody. You know, that's a no-win situation no matter who's in power. And I think ultimately, you know, the worst case scenario for those people is that Democrats lose enough seats in the Senate and the House that they're just unable to pass this legislation. I think you know what you'll end up seeing then is this, you know, the stimulus will be all spent up and there will be new fights over what, you know, Republicans will call for cuts in various social programs, and Democrats will say if we have to pay for extending unemployment benefits, then we're going to do it with tax increases or something like that. And that's just that fight will go on forever. And
I suppose the calculus changes a lot if Democrats lose the House.
Yeah, if Democrats lose the House,
and if that's the case, then this becomes in some ways a Republican problem.
Right, exactly.
And Republicans will actually have to figure out what they really want to do on this.
Right.
And I mean, ideally, I would like to see if Republicans are going to address this, I would like to see Republicans address this by figuring out a way to pay for it over the actual amount of time that they expect to pay for it, rather than sort of incremental bills where, you know, on borrowed money. I think I don't know if you read Keith Hennessy, but Keith Hennessy actually pulled up the Bush one's OMB, the Office of Management and Budget in 1991 under Bush one created a definition of what counts as emergency spending, and they said it had to meet a 5-part test. It had to be necessary, sudden, urgent, unforeseen, and not permanent. And I'm not really sure that that this sort of thing meets the sudden and unforeseen qualifications. And I'd like to see Republicans at least, you know, I mean, if they're going to take this over and make this an issue, I would like to see Republicans actually sort of take that into account that, okay, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it. We're going to plan for it in advance and we're going to pay for it. But I think as well, yeah, it becomes a Republican problem potentially in November. And then we get to find out sort of where Republicans actually stand on this, which I think we can sort of, I don't know, unless you have, if you have anything else you want to say about the unemployment, but we can sort of move on to some of the deficit politics that we've seen this week.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing I'd say is that you know, this isn't foreseen, or this isn't unforeseen, you know, over the.
Well, if Gibbs is saying, yeah, we're going to do this again in November, or effectively saying, sure, it's going to happen.
Right. It just depends what Hennessy means by unforeseen. Did he mean that the you know, 3-year unemployment crisis was unforeseen, or that the need to extend benefits 6 months, a year longer than initially predicted when the original unforeseen event occurred, was that the unforeseen thing? I think, you know, clearly the latter rendering, you know, we're going to be needing unemployment benefits to be extended for a long time, and we foresee that now. But it's all part of a greater sort of economic crisis that wasn't foreseen, and the length of which was always sort of indeterminate. And so, you know, just in that regard, I think once you're in the situation, even if the month by month passage of unemployment extensions is something that you realize that you're going to have to do month in, month out for maybe even years, the point is that the broader economic environment that's forcing that, you know, has taken Congress by surprise, and so they've got to do what they've got to do, you know, until the economy improves. But anyway, we can talk about deficit hypocrisy or whatever.
Well, I think you know, I think it's tough to say, you know, how exactly to categorize this as foreseen or unforeseen, but it does strike me that we certainly, you know, are looking at doing this again in 6 months and probably 6 months after that. If Democrats are in power, I think that it will, you know, it seems to me that's definitely on the table. And if Republicans are in power, they will certainly, it will be put to them as, are you going to do this? Now, whether or not they will, I don't know. And I couldn't make that call, but it is going to be, you know, but we know that 6 months from now, it's almost certainly going to come up again. And the fact that it's being done, you know, sort of, quickly on borrowed money, without a long-term plan, even though there is the wide expectation that it will probably have to happen again every 6 months, it strikes me as a bit of, at least something of an abuse of the emergency spending power. But again, you know, we go back to what's happened with Republicans, and this is made. This has been all over the blogs this week, is that, you know, John Kyle said, basically, I don't think, you know, I think we should always offset spending, but we don't ever need to offset tax cuts. And Mitch McConnell backed him up, you know, and both of them sort of said, yeah, because, you know, we have no reason to offset tax cuts, because if you look at the Bush tax cuts, for example, they raised revenue enough that it didn't matter, that there were no effects. And then you had on Meet the Press, you had Senators Cornyn and Sessions, I believe, who, you know, said, yeah, we're, you know, we're all about cutting the deficit. We've got to, you know, we've got to make that our priority. We've got to get this deficit under control. And then absolutely refused to provide any sort of indication as to what they wanted to do. And one of them, I can't remember which one of them, in fact said, what we need to do is we need to wait until December when the president's fiscal commission, which a bunch of Republicans opposed, as I recall, understandably, when the president's fiscal commission reports back. And so, you know, this doesn't strike me as very inspiring, as giving a lot of hope that Republicans will be at all responsible when, you know, if they come into power, if they have a, you know, even there may be a little bit more in the House, but certainly in the Senate, where things tend to get jammed up, if they can't talk about it now because it's simply too politically difficult, are they really going to get political, you know, get a spine in December after the election? Strikes me as unlikely. And if they're so bereft of ideas that they've got to wait for a commission that many members of their party opposed to get back to them, then again, not very inspiring. Doesn't really strike me as terribly serious here. So, you know, I think the deficit thing is certainly weighing on a lot of politicians' minds right now. There was a story in the Washington Post about this morning, I believe it was this morning, about conservative Democrats, you know, being really worried about this sort of thing. But no one really seems to be able to do anything about it. I guess I'm just sort of, I'm wondering, I obviously politicians are, you know, feel this as a weight, but other than sort of, other than occasionally oppose unemployment benefits for a month, they don't seem to be doing much about it. And I guess I'm sort of wondering what your take and sort of what the political side of this is, or if politicians, you know, have ideas about where they want to go with this sort of thing, or if they just want to drag this debate on forever or not, but not actually ever take any action.
I mean, I think there's very little daylight between you and me on this. I think, for whatever reason, Republicans made a calculated political decision to make this election, make their push to retake Congress and make gains in the Senate about deficits, even though all they can do is demagogue Democrats on deficits and have no track record and no particular ideas that they can openly embrace on exactly how to reduce deficits. And they're just hoping that they may be right, that having their bluff called repeatedly, their reporters, pundits, et cetera, just won't harm them and won't sort of give the lie to the whole ruse. But I mean, there's, you know, there are ideas out there that don't belong to Republican leadership. The Republican leadership kind of wants no part of to reduce the deficit without raising taxes, and it basically involves slashing popular entitlement programs pretty dramatically. And you know, until you have a Republican Party that's willing to entertain the idea of raising taxes in some way, they're going to be stuck calling for a combination of tax cuts, which add to the deficit, and entitlement cuts, which voters absolutely hate. And even that isn't a mathematical recipe for erasing deficits over any term. So, you know, there's going to have to be some sort of come to Jesus moment in the Republican Party that they, A, need to either get out of whatever bubble it is they're in that makes them really believe that cutting taxes reduces the deficit, or they need to wean themselves off of, you know, Club for Growth's like type politics and political pressures, so that they can get behind some kind of tax increase package that will bring revenue into the government, so that they don't have to back these really unpopular entitlement slashing ideas, or else it really is just demagoguery. And I think
eventually this has to. It's not just Republicans. It's the American, you know, it's voters in America to some extent, and not that they've got to like make a single clear decision. Voters can't do that exactly, but at some point, the public is going to have to kind of reconcile its hatred of tax hikes with its love of entitlements. And like, and it's there's this continual war between Republicans and Democrats and free market types and sort of their, you know, political opponents about whether tax hikes are more unpopular or entitlements are more, you know, are popular, are more popular than tax hikes. And, you know, but, and it's not really clear to me, at least, which, like, when push comes to shove, which, you know, the majority of the public wants. I think we're going to have to find that out in the next decade or so, perhaps sooner, perhaps in the next couple of years. And it's going to be really interesting. But, you know, but, and it strikes me that that, in fact, is part of the problem for the conservative Democrats that the Washington Post was reporting on, and for Republicans right now, is that they're looking for, you know, they've, you know, Republicans have been the anti-tax party for a long time, and that's worked really well. But you can only go so far with that if you're spending like we are. And some of that spending eventually becomes very, very popular, as we've seen with Medicare and other entitlements. And so they're sort of trying to figure out how they're going to position themselves for the next couple of years, the next decade, and sort of, and the coming sort of fiscal shakeout here, wherever it goes. And they're getting confused because the old lines don't work. The old, you know, the old position of we just won't ever hike taxes and it'll be okay because if we cut taxes, it'll raise revenue. It's just not working. And so I think, you know, sort of the Republicans, it's not just, it's a policy problem. It's also sort of a political positioning problem, over the long term. I certainly know where I hope things come down. I'm in favor of a Paul Ryan style, you know, sort of entitlement slashing. But I don't know what the American people really want, because it's not clear. Whenever you see the polling, they hate tax hikes. They love entitlements. They wanted to have low taxes and to have Medicare fully funded forever.
You know what? I think what the public really hates is demagoguery about tax hikes. I think that they, you know, they believe that Barack Obama has raised their taxes, when basically that's just not true. They, you know, rhetoric about that resonates with them. Like you said, just over the last several years, the idea that voters will always and forever respond to the party that says we will cut your taxes, it just isn't true if other X factors like entitlement cuts and growing inequality, et cetera, are part of the picture. I think that despite the fact that the economy is bad and Democrats are going to suffer because of it, I don't think that dynamic has gone away. And I don't think it will until, you really get to a harmonious period in American history again, and who knows how long that will take if it ever happens. I mean,
well, I think Democrats, you know, actually, thinking about this, Democrats seem to have actually put themselves in a very good spot and are playing this rather well with you know, sort of modified versions of the Orzag line that healthcare reform is entitlement reform.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the argument that Jack Lew, the new OMB director, has played this line pretty strong for the past decade or so, and sort of, you know, has been pushing this same basic idea, which is that, you know, we do actually have to be good fiscal stewards, and we have to be good fiscal stewards in order to shore up progressive policy preferences, and that seems, you know, politically, at least, that seems like it's been a very smart play, and that's how the Democrats have moved forward, by kind of playing both sides of we're going to care about deficits, we're going to care about the budget, and making sure that the numbers add up, but we're also going to give you your goodies, and that's been that's been a fairly successful line that Republicans have not been able to respond to, and don't really, well, they haven't been able to respond to from a messaging perspective, but they haven't been able to come up with policy alternatives to
right.
it either.
Right.
Until they can figure out how to address that disparity, it at least strikes me that Democrats are going to continue to make gains on them in sort of the in terms of how whether or not the public trusts them fiscally or not.
I think that's right. I think that's right. Well, I mean, I'd say a couple of things. One, just on the general point, I think that any you know of that tiny universe of people who really cares about deficits, they owe it to themselves to join the Democratic Party, because frankly, like going back 30 years, every president has added to deficits over their term, but Republicans far and away by greater amounts. The second point I'd make is that what you have more than an entitlement problem here is a healthcare problem,
right?
And the healthcare bill that passed, if enacted as passed, and if not changed dramatically, and if things turn out as predicted, will cut into that somewhat, but not nearly enough to actually restore the country to fiscal balance. I mean, still projections are that healthcare right. will sink this country. I just don't see how either party gets to the place where they can enact that magical healthcare reform that really, really overhauls the system in a way that slows growth in healthcare spending and is paid for with some sort of non-regressive tax. Until you figure that out, like either this healthcare bill is a big failure and it's kind of back to the drawing board again, or it takes Democrats have to keep returning to this bill to make it incrementally more and more and more and more fiscally sound. Other than one of those two ponies, I don't see how either party gets to a place where the actual problem of ballooning deficits is solved. Probably you can make a lot of money if you
right. Well, if you've got the magic answer, you can definitely make a lot of money. On the other hand, the systems that cannot go on forever will eventually stop. And it strikes me, I am not nearly as happy with the Democrats as you are in terms of budgeting. Not that, like I said, I'm happy with Republicans either. I don't really trust either party on this. I'm not sure the incentives are terribly aligned. I think Democrats have much better messaging right now, and Republicans are sort of still flailing.
I mean, what do you think about the Carter, Reagan, Bush Sr., Bill Clinton, George W. Bush track record of actual Democrat and Democratic.
Well, I mean, if you look at the surpluses of the Clinton years, they came during a time of gridlock. It was when Washington was fighting rather than passing bills, and Clinton was sort of had been chastened by healthcare reform, and he wasn't able to do what he wanted. Parties that have like I said, Republicans have not been good on this by any means. Clinton ended up being the best, I think, in large part because he decided to go for micro initiatives, to go small, to stay small, and because he was distracted from doing big things and prevented by Republicans and by the political climate, tawdry as it may have been. We ended up with pretty sound fiscal situation at that point. And I think if you look at that, it shows that you it's not that you trust one party or another. It's that you trust the two parties, or the best trust you can give is that the two parties will serve as checks on each other.
But we're not talking about spending. We're talking about deficits.
Right, and you had surpluses in the Clinton years.
But I mean, what initiatives did Clinton ever spearhead, failed or successful, that in absence of a Congress that did very little, would have ballooned the deficit? I mean, I can't remember a single non-defense Clinton initiative that was just thrown out there without a plan to pay for it.
Right, and I think that a large part of the reason was that that he, like I said, he was chastened. He had an he had Republicans in Congress who were going to check him, and because deficits were a big deal at that point. In order to work with Republicans, in order to work in that sort of political environment, and in order to to make things work at that point, given the Republicans being there, I think that's what Clinton had to do. And I think that's a large part of what stops things. It's not that I trust Republicans on this, but I'm not, terribly convinced, certainly by Obama's record so far. The modern Democratic presidencies, yes, Clinton was by far the best, but that was, he had Republican opposition sort of helping him out.
And of course, Obama's record is, if you just look at the numbers, it's besmirched by the fact that he came into office and was faced with.
I don't want to downplay the fact that George Bush is responsible for a huge amount of and the Bush presidency is responsible for a huge amount of the fiscal problems that we have today and for the deficit situation. So don't misread me there. However. I have also not been entirely convinced by Obama's record here. Go ahead.
Well, I think basically we've rounded out that discussion. I'm not sure what else there is. Unless you have another thought about what's going on right now with the two parties, their rhetoric, their policies on.
Well, I think we can move on to financial regulation again, you being on the Hill, you probably have a better sort of sense of what's going on there and how that's moved recently. If you want to sort of set us up, tell us where we're at here.
That's passed. It's done. It'll be signed tomorrow. It'll be law. Republicans are – John Boehner has called for it to be repealed. Others have called for it to be repealed, though not with the same gusto with which they called for health care reform to be repealed, because obviously reforming Wall Street is pretty popular, and reforming health care never really was. I'd be curious to get your take on, why Republicans are wedded to opposing the bill and even calling for it to be repealed. And whether there's they have a legitimate policy argument, or if it's just that they have negotiated themselves into such a corner with their own base that they really have, they really can't afford to support anything major anyway that Democrats do successfully push through Congress.
Well, like I've said before, I don't think that the financial reform bill debate has been informed by a whole lot of deep policy knowledge. The debate has basically been Democrats are against banks and Republicans are against Democrats. Depending on who you hate more, it'll tell you who, what side you support here. It seems pretty clear to me, like you said, Republicans don't have the option of supporting any major Democratic initiative. And that combined with the fact that a lot of traditional Republican interests, constituents are not in favor of this. You have Wall Street, which has given a lot of money to Democrats, but also has a lot of friends on the right amongst Republicans. Wall Street certainly hasn't been happy with a lot of this. Some banks have been happier. Some banks have gotten more of what they wanted. But by and large, Wall Street, certainly there were things that they didn't like here. But I think also, Republicans, if there's anything, the best critique that has come out of the right is that what the bill does, I guess it'll be a law here very soon. A lot of what the law does is sort of kick the problem down the road and kick figuring out how to solve it down the road. You have so much of the bill is sort of here. We're going to conduct studies. We're going to assign regulators to figure out how to do this. without actually saying, here's what we're going to do to solve a lot of the problems. But for Republicans, again, I don't even know if the, like I said, I don't think the policy is the primary thing. I think the opposition to the Democrats is the primary thing. And their base is not going to let them support a major Democratic initiative.
So how long can they get away with that? I mean, we're getting pretty close to the election. And why do you think it is that Democrats aren't accepting the political reality that faces them and just rule 14 and just bringing bill after bill after bill after bill that's difficult for Republicans to oppose to the floor and forcing them to oppose them and then running on, you know, see, they oppose Wall Street reform and expanding Medicare and puppies. What's behind those two things?
Republicans definitely oppose Medicare and puppies.
Yes, they do.
That's in the platform, as I understand. I mean, Republicans, you know, this is opposition tactics, and we'll see some of this. Not that I don't think Republicans are going to win the Senate here, but if Republicans were to win both the House and the Senate, I think you'd see more of this amongst Democrats. Is that if Republicans had major initiatives that they had branded as major Republican initiatives, Democrats would be reflexively. Would reflexively oppose them. This is what minority parties do. Republicans will not be able to get away with it at the point that they actually have to lead, at the point that they actually have some power. I'm not sure what they're going to do. I mean, if you look at the front page of National Review today, there's a unsigned editorial from the editors that says something to the effect of Republicans need to come up with a frickin' agenda. And they don't have one right now. Their agenda is oppose Democrats. It's worked well enough so far. I'm not sure that's what's actually helping them. How much it's helping them so much as just the bad economy. The bad economy is the main thing that's helping Republicans right now. But Republicans see their fortunes tied up in opposing Democrats, at least while they're in the minority, while they don't have the opportunity to put forth things that they want to put forth. And my guess is that as long as that's the case, they're going to keep doing so.
Yeah, I mean, they do have something of an agenda. It's repeal the health care bill and repeal the financial reform bill. And either by cowing Democrats into doing it or doing it themselves is extend the Bush tax cuts without offsetting the incurred deficits in any way. A program of pretty massive deregulation.
But even those first two items you said there, you know, I don't even think of that as necessarily an agenda, because it's following the same pattern. It's opposing what the Democrats did. Now, Republicans need to do that, I think, as a minority party. This is the role that they have. It's the game they play. Good, bad, whatever. But it's not an agenda of things they want to do on their own, and it's also.
But I think it
I
is.
Mean, I, you know, I'm no fan of the healthcare bill, as you know. But like, but repealing the healthcare bill while without controlling the Senate or the White House, I don't really feel like that's going to happen.
No,
like,
of course it's not going to happen. I mean, you know, of course it's not going to happen. I guess look if you're the minority party and you're trying to prove to the country that you have an agenda. Then you know you lay out what you're for and you lay out what you might possibly accomplish. They want to repeal the healthcare bill and in a magical world replace it with, you know, the something like the Republican alternative that they, you know, sort of pro forma put on the floor of the Senate and failed. But in the real world, what they can do and what they've, you know, said openly that they're going to do is use whatever power that they have, whether it's of the purse or over regulatory agencies, to slow down and gut the healthcare law, and to do the same with financial reform and you know, that includes Republican leaders calling for a moratorium on non-emergency rule writing and regulations in the government. I think that's an agenda. What they would characterize as a pro-business agenda, that businesses are stifled by all these new regulations and the healthcare bill, and that if we're going to turn the country around, we need businesses to create jobs, and this is what they're telling us. I disagree, but that's what's going on up here. And it's not you know, the most comprehensive agenda like the ones that the Democrats had in 2008 when Obama was running for the White House, where they had a plan to address climate change and a plan to deal with health care and an education plan and, you know, a zillion white papers that they wrote up over, you know, the dozen plus years they were out of power. But it is something. I mean, it's a pretty strong statement of what they would do when they took office. And they're not going out on the road and bragging about it, because a lot of it isn't popular at all. But they are saying it. In fact, over the last 3-4 weeks, they've been much more open about the sort of things that they would like to do if they took over the House than they were for the first 16 months or whatever of Obama's presidency. I mean, I think that they think that they're bulletproof and that they can get away with making a lot of these arguments because they're just that they're going to do well in November no matter what. But
they're also hearing a lot of it from their base and from certainly from the business community.
I think is
on board with
it. It doesn't come out of nowhere.
And so, you know, it's not, I mean, and this is, without even taking a position, this is what politicians do. They listen to the, you know, to their constituents, listen to their supporters. And so, for Republicans, that's where their supporters are at right now to a large extent. The business community really is, I think, not entirely wrongly worried about regulation. We've seen a huge amount of new law passed that is going to impact the domestic business community a whole lot. It's going to drastically change how business is done in the country over the next 3 to 5 years. And because we've seen a lot of it happen, and because Republicans and conservative pundits are talking about it, business leaders have picked up on this sort of thing, and so then they start calling their congressmen, and so it's not as if congressmen, you will see some of that, but it doesn't. But again, this strikes me as less of a substantive agenda than opposing what Democrats did. And in some ways, it's a solution to the problem that the business community has right now with worry about regulation and regulatory uncertainty. But that strikes me as a useful thing to some extent. But you've got to have a lot more than that. An agenda is not simply here's what we're going to do for our business interests. That's not actually all that much of an agenda.
Can I ask you a terribly loaded question, which is not.
Can I stop you? Is there a way that I can? No, I
just, not Tom Donahue and your archetypal evil CEO. But do you think that the American business community is so fragile and so vulnerable to the whims of government that the regulations called for and kind of punted down the road in any of the big Democratic initiatives would dramatically harm their interests or the broader economy? Or is it just that they kind of don't want to deal with labor law enforcement provisions and healthcare stuff, and they just kind of prefer things as they were before?
I don't think I would go with either of those prefab responses that you gave me. I think what I would say is that many businessmen are concerned about their bottom line. That's what makes them good businessmen. That's how you run a successful business, is that you worry constantly about how much it costs to do business and how much you're going to make from it. And how much you stand to make if you do new things. And what all the new regulations and all the new rules are doing is adding to the cost of business. They're adding to the cost of business, and they're adding to the planning costs of planning new businesses. And because you have a lot of uncertainty right now with the financial bill, there's still a lot of businessmen who don't really understand the healthcare bill. And I think some of that is entirely reasonable. Some of it's the fact that businessmen don't actually spend all day reading policy papers like journalists do. And they're very worried about what those costs are going to end up being. is it going to end up, are these laws going to end up shuttering, you know, huge portions of the American, of American business? No, probably not. You never know the future, but probably not. But what it's going to do is it going to make doing business more expensive and more difficult. And that's what businessmen care about all the time. And they've got to deal with that from their customers, from their suppliers, from the market, all the time. And what they don't want is more of that coming from Washington.
Right, right.
So that's what they're worried about. And they do make decisions based on that.
But, you know, the way they characterize it, you would think that a tsunami of regulation was going to drown them, and that the U.S. economy would just disappear, would be in total ruins. And I mean, obviously, they have to talk about it like that, or if they were just like, well, it's not ideal, but we can live with it, then they're just going to be susceptible to more and more and more of it. But it is a political line that they're taking. You know, that they're maximizing their negotiating positions by over exaggerating how harmful these regulations will be on them. And
but this is just what unions do when they negotiate with their employers.
Sure.
This is just what unions do when they negotiate with. I mean, this is and if it's it's this is how political negotiation is done. And every, you know, all of the major interest groups.
I'm totally with you on that. The how that maps onto U.S. politics, though, is very uneven. I mean, unions are a Democratic constituency, but they by no means get what they want, either rhetorically or governance-wise, out of Democrats. Republicans are basically, you know, you saw it happen on Friday. Or I don't know if you did. You know, the Republicans set up this roundtable discussion with conservative trade associations and big business groups and stuff. They were gonna have it. News of it broke. Democrats demanded that they put it on camera, so they had this sort of kabuki roundtable that they broadcast on the internet. And not, you know, it was kabuki, but it was exactly what you know you're seeing Republicans start to sort of run on, and they just took business. Trade group representatives at their word that Obama era's regulations were going to destroy them, and they said, you know, if given back control of the House, our top objective will be to reverse all of that and to cut corporate tax rates. And then Boehner, you know, went right out and held a press conference where he called for a moratorium on non-emergency rule writing and regulation. I mean, obviously they can't do all of that, but it just seems like they're much more hand in glove with that aspect of their base, or their fundraising base anyway, than Democrats are with unions. So you know, the agenda or the stuff that they're running on, it looks a lot like the stuff that they did from depending on where you start the clock, 1994 or whatever through 2006 or 2008. And they keep getting caught because that's just the stuff that George Bush did. And George Bush remains terribly unpopular. And so Republicans are at pains to say no, they don't want to go back to the Bush agenda, but they can't name anything that they would really do differently. But they're also unable to say that anything Obama's done has been an improvement on Bush. I don't really know if I have a question at the end of all this, but I feel like there's a degree to which Republicans are in hock to their major funders that you just don't have on the Democratic side, and it really shoehorns them into a very narrow range of policy prescriptions, and that's what you're seeing ahead of these elections.
Whereas I would say that I think that it's easy for Republicans to pander to their interests right now when they're out of power and don't have to bother with following through, and they can make all sorts of magical fantasy promises about what they're going to do in the future with regards to repealing this or that that's not actually going to get repealed. And it does strike me that the Democrats tend to take the word of their constituents, especially when they're out of power, and especially on sort of issues that don't, where they don't have to follow through. If Republicans take the House again in 2010, at the end of this year, I think you'll see that change, because they won't be able to just give a press conference about how they're going to stop all regulation for now and forever. They will actually have to, if they want to do that, they're going to have to follow through on it. But I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe this is their agenda, and maybe that's what they've got, and that's what we're all in store for.
I mean, you know more conservatives than I do. Although I meet more and more all the time. What would you guess? They take the House. I could see them joining hands with Democrats and upping the retirement age on Social Security or something like that.
Though that's usually a trade. I mean, the talk I hear is that that's a trade for a tax hike, and whether Republicans are going to be able to eat that is not. I don't think so.
Certainly
in the more conservative quarters, which are increasingly more Republicans these days, they're not interested in taking that deal. They are definitely interested in changing, in reducing benefits on Social Security, upping the retirement age, that sort of thing. They're not interested in a tax hike as a deal. Whether or not you eventually end up with enough moderate Republicans and Democrats to do that, I don't know. But at least the conservative Republicans who I've talked to are very much not interested and will expend a lot of effort to make sure that deal doesn't happen. I don't know where we're going from that.
Anything else you see out there?
The 1099 requirement in Obamacare for small businesses, I wouldn't be surprised if that goes away. You know, and it was a revenue raiser that they stuck in the bill where a bunch of small businesses are going to have to end up doing a whole bunch more 1099s, and adds tremendously to the paperwork. In theory, it brings in, I think, about $17 billion to pay for the bill. My guess is that goes away, because it's pretty absurd and pretty onerous, and you've already seen folks introducing bills just to try and get rid of that. And if I recall correctly, there's been at least a couple of conservative Democrats who've said, let's go ahead and get rid of this thing.
Is it a bunch of trimming around the margins, or is, like, let's say Democrats can't pass an energy bill this Congress, do you see Republicans working with Democrats to kind of do something along the lines of what either Lamar Alexander or Dick Lugar has proposed, just as an energy only bill, or no?
You know, I don't know. I don't know where Republicans. I mean, like I said, I think there are some obvious small bore things that in terms of repealing very tiny provisions from Obamacare or perhaps from the Finneg bill. But for the most part, I don't know, because I don't think Republicans know. I think that there's a conservative you have a couple of factions. You have sort of the clueless old style Republicans who want to keep saying, well, let's just cut taxes and run on that, and we can just keep claiming that they raise enough revenue. And then you have the conservative Republicans who are not really policy sharp. They're just very conservative and, oh, that's against government. You know, that's a small government move. It's pro-business. Let's do that. And then you have the smallest faction, which is sort of the Paul Ryan types, who are at least looking to engage in a policy discussion, whether or not it's one that liberals like or want to have, whether or not there's anybody who's interested really in taking them up on that. They're at least making some effort to engage in a policy discussion. What did they end up in? Suggesting most of the time, however, are large scale cuts to entitlements that, at least in the foreseeable future, 18 months or so, aren't going to happen. So that's where I see the Republican establishment right now, and sort of the conservative universe. And from that, I don't know where you get a governing agenda, where you get a leadership agenda.
Well, I don't think there really is one aside from, you know, working whatever levers they have if they control a single House of Congress to gum up what Democrats have already accomplished, which is what they're saying they want to do.
And that may then just be it, is that even if they control the House, they may simply continue to act as a minority party and portray themselves as effectively a minority party who is just stopping the Obama agenda.
And if that's
what they think is going to be the best way to get to 2012, then I have no doubt that that's what they'll go forward with.
Given that, I think, very likely scenario, what's better for the country, Republicans taking the House or Democrats controlling it with a very small majority and a somewhat relatively larger majority, though still diminished in the Senate?
I'm not a team player here. In general, I like gridlock, and so I'd at least be curious to see what some gridlock brings us. But I don't have a strong preference for any party, and so my line on this, unfortunately, is always a bit of a cop out. It's a shame they can't both lose.
There would be, I think, a great deal of gridlock if Democrats had, 220 seats in the House and 54 or 53 seats in the Senate. There'd be very little other than, appropriations bills and very, very small bore things that they could get done. They really did accomplish the vast bulk of what President Obama set out to accomplish this Congress. So it's not like there would be much pressure on him to do, another major initiative, although there are many people extremely disappointed with what hasn't happened on climate change. So you could get that gridlock either, coming or going. And it's actually unclear to me how outcomes for real people would be much different one way or another. And my sense is that at the margin, at the very least, things would function more smoothly. You would not have Republicans, if they really are going to act as an opposition party, if they take over the House, trying to defund Obamacare, trying to, inject a bit more of that uncertainty into the lives of regular folk. But that's just me.
I think we can sort of pivot from that fairly easily here. We've got just a couple minutes left where we can. I don't know if you want to talk about the spate of essays, starting with the Eric Alterman piece. Sort of about liberal disappointment in Obama. You talked about how Democrats have actually accomplished quite a bit in terms of substantive agenda. But I do, I get this sense from a lot of the hardcore progressives they're saying very explicitly, we're really disappointed. And I guess I sort of wonder, and maybe you can explain this to me, what was Obama supposed to do? From where I'm sitting, and again, not a supporter, not a liberal, but from where I'm sitting, Obama has accomplished quite a lot, and in fact has accomplished more in terms of domestic policy than, and certainly any president since Reagan, and possibly back further than that. I mean, what was he supposed to do? Because actually, with all the disappointment, the tearing, the sackcloth and ashes here, I'm not actually seeing a lot in the way of suggestions of what Obama was supposed to have done, other than talk more sternly or something, and what Obama is supposed to do going forward. Are there actual specific, things that progressives want from Obama?
The progressive elite has five or six different opinions or answers to that question. I think that at the margin, he could have done a little more. He could have made his achievements a bit more appealing to people like Eric Alterman, who basically give him a pass. Or people like Jane Hampshire who think that he's He's just a Democratic George W. Bush, I guess.
Bit of a stretch.
Yeah. I'll say I'm somewhere between the two of them. To pick one issue where a lot of elite progressives were disappointed was the public option. By all appearances, the public option was sort of a bargaining chip for President Obama. Rightly or wrongly, he was never going to get behind it, and he didn't want to blow up his sort of business coalition that was helping him get the bill passed. But I think that was a calculation he made before he realized that it was going to cause him all kinds of problems with the media and with fundraisers, with supporters, etc. And that if he could have gone back to the negotiating table and said, look, I'm getting a lot of heat. Let's figure out a way to get some weak version of this public option into the bill so that I can appease them and also figure out a way to do it in a way that doesn't, blow up your support for it. And I think that he had enough levers as the leader of the Democratic Party to go to those recalcitrant Democratic lawmakers and not allow them to do his bidding for him, which is what I think he ultimately did, but force them to vote with their party and stop gumming up the works. I certainly think he could have taken a stronger hand in making sure the health care bill passed earlier than it did. And I think that he just he blew that one. A few more things. I think he could have played procedural hardball in the Senate more. I think he could have for those 4 months or whatever it was that Democrats really did have 60 votes, made some demands on people in his own party to get a lot of stuff done that he had promised to get done. And instead he just he and Harry Reid let Senate Democrats fight amongst themselves over marginal aspects of the health care bill. So, he didn't play it perfectly, but it's not like he sold out or enacted a legislative agenda that was wildly different from the one that he ran on. In fact, with the exception of I'll say legislative agenda because there's a big difference between what he talked about in terms of civil liberties and national security than what he did when he took office. But the major domestic agenda items that he promised to push for as president, he came pretty close to the mark. To the extent that he couldn't do better or get more done as far as progressives are concerned, by and large, it wasn't his failure to tie Blanche Lincoln into knots or whatever. It was procedural things like the filibuster. Like if there was no filibuster, these last 2 years would have been way easier on him. He could have passed a bigger stimulus. Which you may not agree, but I believe would have left the employment situation much better. He could have passed a more ambitious healthcare bill, one that bent the cost curve more, one that insured more people with better insurance. Go down the list. The stuff that did pass could have been marginally better, and the stuff that didn't or won't pass might have been able to. And that's really where I think the bulk of the differences between his candidacy and his governing have been as far as domestic legislation.
So in a lot of ways, it's a liberal frustration with the fact that American democracy is not as swift or malleable as they would like that they've projected onto Obama?
I think that for his strongest critics on the left, that's a big part of it. And I think, I think a lot of them, who am I to say whether they're right or wrong to be as mad as they are at him for not being more of a fighter and more of a, procedural opportunist and so on and so on. I also wish he had sort of done as much as he could at every point, and you know, not let the political powers that be in the White House dissuade him from that, which they seem to have to some extent. But you know, I think that he has from the beginning showed a pretty strong deference to institutions as they are, and has tried to squeeze as much out of them as he possibly could, and has taken the long view that if he comes close to the mark and does good things for voters, then voters will reward Democrats, and you know, I think when you have yourself as president 4 years before your next election, you have a long time to you know, to let the fruits of your policies bear out. And if the economy is bad as it was when he took office, you have a lot of time to allow the economy to recover, and so, you know, I can also see why he might not have wanted to put himself on the line to fail a few times when structurally he's, you know, pretty well positioned for re-election. But that said, if these structural impediments hadn't been in place when he took office, I think he would have had a much more successful first 18 months, and I think that there would have been somewhat, though not a ton, less carping on the left. And that's just where we are. You know, I think that the Alterman piece actually lays it out pretty fairly.
I guess it's just interesting to me that you sort of describe the worries about structural impediments, which to me just seem like democracy and the American, you know, Washington, the rules of Congress,
which are not democratic. You
know, right. Well, yes, but the American democracy, which is not actually democracy, we're a republic where we've got with a complicated set of rules intended to intended in large part to slow. You know, and in fact, to block at times the movements, you know, sort of the rapid movement of democracy, and to me, this just it strikes me as kind of a funny way of being frustrated with the rules of Washington is to write very long essays about how you know, about what a disappointment the most progressive president in, you know, several decades has been, you know, again, as a non-liberal, as someone who I perhaps do not understand here, I think that certainly has enlightened me. I don't know if you have anything else to say on that, or if we're about ready to wrap up here.
I think we're about ready to wrap up. I think you know, I would just say that activists' jobs are to push their leaders, their political leaders, to be as you know, as rigidly progressive or conservative as possible. And so a lot of the dissatisfaction is just activists being activists. Whether there's actually people out there who are legitimately legitimately under the impression that it's not that the structures that were in place that hindered Obama were less at fault than Obama himself, I don't know if that's an answerable question, but certainly I think it's legitimate for people to complain that he didn't work, you know, within the system enough to squeeze as much as possible out of it, and I think that
no, that makes sense. Actually, I guess I hadn't thought of that. I didn't get that reading the Alterman piece. You know,
right. Well, I don't think that
if we've got this system of rules, you may as well work it as much as you can.
Right. You know, and I don't know that was one of the, I don't know if that was really Alterman's main point. I just from my perspective, I think that the system just was never going to allow Barack Obama to get to have, you know, to preside over outcomes that made progressive elites and progressive activists super happy. But that those restraints were there before he took office and aren't really his fault. And therefore the critique should be limited to what he did to, or did not do to milk that system. And frankly, I think that that's a much more interesting conversation that progressives should be having amongst themselves than the one that they are, which is kind of like a food fight between, you know, very angry activists and medium angry activists and Obama apologists, kind of all on different sides of this thing. But
well, as a libertarian who is also frequently frustrated by the system's inability to go nearly as far in the direction that I would like, as I want, I sympathize. And I suppose with that, we can wrap things up. It's been very nice talking to you, as always, sir.
All right. Thanks, Peter.
Have a great evening.
Bye-bye.